I think it's probably about time we should begin. I might remind you before making an introduction of the procedure, Professor Ackenstein will give a fairly formal lecture, at the end of which we'll have a short break of about 5 minutes and then return here for a general discussion for about half an hour. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the Lakatos Award Lecture for the book Particles and Waves, written by Peter Ackenstein. Okay. The book for which Peter Ackenstein shares this year's Lakatos Award is, as I've just said, Particles and Waves, Historical Essays in the Philosophy of Science. Surprisingly, for those of us brought up on the EPR paradox and the problems of wave-particle duality, this book is not about quantum mechanics, but about 19th century physics. Young and Fresnel on the wave aspects of light, Clark Maxwell's kinetic theory of gases, and J.J. Thomson's experiments on the electron. It is about 19th century physics, and it is about method, both then and now, about modes of scientific reasoning, patterns of explanation, the role of formal derivation, and the place of experiment. It teaches us about these crucial historical episodes and the realistic and careful account of these three different 19th century episodes allows Ackenstein a new, more subtle, more realistic articulation of concepts of scientific explanation and of scientific warrant. Now, you must know that the Lakatos Award goes to the best book of the year in the philosophy of science, taking the field broadly. It is not in any way specific to books associated with the ideas of Imre Lakatos. But Particles and Waves is in the model of Lakatos's work. It is historical reconstruction in the best of senses. It leads us to a better, clearer understanding of the historical episodes in their epistemic dimensions, and it teaches important lessons for current methodology. You must also know that the philosophy department at LSE has nothing to do with the choice of the award winners. That is done by an international committee which is inconveniently located in various bits of Australia, America, and Europe. Okay. Nevertheless, in this respect as well, Particles and Waves is a book of special local interest. The philosophy department here is a small, active group, and Peter Ackenstein's book speaks to the serious research interests of every one of its members. John Worrell on Fresnel and Young, Hausen and Orbach on Bayesian inference, Elie Zohar on the rise of modern science, Newton, Maxwell, and Thomson, and David Rubin and me on modes of explanation. Now, I don't mention the LSE department in the tone of one of the referees for Peter's book, who said something like this: "Look, this book is so good that one might even see it as a precursor to my own splendid work." Rather, I mention it, my department, as a way of pointing to the breadth of scope and richness of this book. There are, after all, 6 full-time faculty in our department, and in this book, Peter Ackenstein is doing the work of all 6 of us. Now, Particles and Waves is the 4th in a distinguished sequence of books by Professor Ackenstein. There's Concepts of Science in 1968, Law and Explanation, which was really an exciting introduction for me to Peter's work, The Nature of Explanation in 83, and finally Particles and Waves in 1991. Peter Ackenstein himself is professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, where he has worked since 1962, with visits along the way to MIT, the Graduate Center at CUNY, and Hebrew University, as well as time off for one of those distinguished Guggenheim fellowships. So I'm very pleased at this moment to pass the floor over to Professor Ackenstein for his lecture this evening. Please, Peter.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for your very generous introduction. I'm deeply honored to be the co-recipient of this year's Lakatosh Award. I'm also honored that the other recipient was one of my PhD students, Alex Rosenberg. So it's nice to keep it in the family. I knew and had great respect for Imre Lakatosh. Over the years, we argued over many issues, from the Vietnam War to the nature of inductive reasoning. And I took it as a great compliment that every time he argued with me, he got very angry with me. My lecture this afternoon relates science and philosophy. And I don't know how many of you have read the recent book by Abraham Pius on Niels Bohr. It's not his most recent one, which is about Einstein again, but the next to the last one was about Niels Bohr. And Abraham Pius tells a story about Bohr. Bohr was asked by someone what the difference is between science and philosophy, since he, Bohr, was doing a bit of both. And Bohr thought about it for a while and said, well, there's not really that much difference between the two. He said the scientist starts out by knowing something about something, and then he learns more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. And whereas the philosopher, he says, also starts out by knowing something about something, and then he learns less and less about more and more till he knows nothing about everything. Well, I don't know where you'll put me on this scale, but I guess I am a philosopher and not a scientist. So I want to talk to you this afternoon about the problem of unobservables, something which scientists frequently postulate. Entities, processes, things, relationships, whatever, that are unobservable, from the atoms of the ancient Greeks to the atoms of today, to the subatomic particles, to the quarks, to the super strings vibrating in 10-dimensional space-time. You get the idea. What is the motivation for these postulations? Why do scientists, particularly physicists, love to postulate these things, though this is not primarily the province of physics? Well, there is the idea that underlying the appearances is a reality. The appearances are what we observe. The reality is what we don't. That's one idea. Another idea is that the large, again, which we observe, is composed of the small. There's a machine which we can observe. We can observe an input and an output, but the machine is like a black box. It has parts and a structure which are very often inaccessible to us. Now, that's another motivation. And a third and related motivation is that scientific explanation requires micro-reduction and unification and simplicity. That is, that there's a set of fundamental parts of the universe, the particles of physics, superstrings, fields of force, whatever, and that everything else can be derived from the laws and the properties of these fundamental parts. That's the goal of scientific explanation. And these fundamental parts are too small or too uninteractive to be observed. All right, well, these are obvious points. What's the problem? Well, the problem is that scientists, of all people, are supposed to be empiricists. That is, they're supposed to base their claims only on what they can and do observe. And how can one be an empiricist if one postulates what one cannot observe? Now, there is a special epistemic problem for unobservables. And I should say that this is not the same as postulating things you could see if you tried, but you haven't yet. For example, the white inside the apple you're about to eat or not about to eat. That's not the problem, because all you got to do is bite and see what color the inside of the apple is. And it's also not the problem of Hume, of how we're justified in going from the crows we have observed to the black, to the ones we haven't yet observed to be black. Just wait around and see them. That's not a problem that I want to raise here. And nor are we talking about things that philosophers of science sometimes call unobservable, but that most scientists would wonder about. That is, they call observable things like electrons and protons. They're observable, they're detectable in cloud chambers and bubble chambers by observing certain very direct effects. No, I'm not talking about these things. What I'm talking about are things, entities, processes that scientists have postulated but could not observe at all, or know how to observe, at least for long periods after they were postulated. If it weren't such an ugly expression, we might call these inaccessible unobservables. I'll simply call them unobservables. Such an unobservable, inaccessible world is anathema to an empiricist. It's to be feared. It's to be ridiculed. Leave it to metaphysics, not to science. How is a scientist postulating such a world any different from a Kantian metaphysician postulating a thing in itself, or a theologian postulating the deity? Well, so much for my initial question. I want to take two cases in 19th century physics. They're both cases that I discuss in the book that Nancy referred to. The first case is a dispute that occurred at the beginning of the 19th century between the wave and the particle theorists of light. It involves light waves and the ether, which is to carry the waves. And the second case involves molecules and the development of the kinetic theory of gases by James Clerk Maxwell in 1860. Both cases involve what physicists at the time and philosophers of physics regarded as unobservable entities and processes. No physicist saw or claimed to see the ether or light waves in the ether, and no physicist claimed to see molecules inside gases. Both cases involve physicists who had very deep philosophical concerns about methodological issues in science, particularly about postulating unobservables. The problem of unobservables is not a problem that was invented just today. It's a problem that goes way back in the history of science. And in the 19th century, two great scientists I'll talk about a little bit were very much concerned with the methods that one uses when one postulates or fails to postulate unobservables, namely John Herschel in connection with the wave theory of light and James Clerk Maxwell in connection with the kinetic theory of gases. Both cases involve very heated scientific controversies. The wave and particle debate, as I mentioned at the beginning of the 19th century, raged through at least the 1840s before the wave theorists claimed absolute victory. And skeptics about molecules. There were numerous skeptics about molecules up until the first decade or more even, of the 20th century. There were outbreaks of fear of unobservables. These outbreaks occur throughout the history of science. In modern times, this fear or absolute terror occurs particularly with respect to atoms and molecules, and is expressed by late 19th century scientists in the so-called positivist tradition, scientists that include Mach and Poincaré and Duhem and Ostwald. Indeed, Ostwald in 1895 complained that scientists postulating atoms were, and I quote, disturbing us with forces the existence of which we cannot demonstrate, acting between atoms which we cannot see. Scientists must stick to what's observable. Unobservables, at best, should be treated instrumentally, not realistically. So my questions about these 19th century episodes are these. First, what sort of arguments did the physicists introducing these unobservables, the light waves and the ether and the atoms, what sorts of arguments did they in fact give? Are they legitimate or reasonable arguments? Are they generalizable ones? Do they have forms that can be used to argue for other unobservables as well? And in Maxwell's case, at least, he argued for his theory without testing it at all. No experiments were given in his initial and perhaps most famous paper of 1860. Is that legitimate? How is it possible? Let me tell you my claims in advance. I hope I'll be able to get through much of this talk, but in case I don't, here's the plot. These episodes represent two different strategies of reasoning in the case of unobservables. Using one strategy, wave theorists argued for the truth or high probability of their theory about unobservable waves and the ether. Using a different strategy, Maxwell argued not for the truth of his theory about unobservable molecules, but for the claim that such a theory was worth pursuing, worth investigating, worth funding, to put it in our own lingo. Both theorists argued for their theories about unobservables. Indeed, wave theorists argue for the truth or moral certainty without ever observing the entities they postulate, that is, the ether and waves in the ether, and without ever observing molecules, and without ever knowing how to observe them. This is a perfectly legitimate thing to do and is done all the time in physics, despite the reservations of many empirically minded philosophers and some physicists themselves. So let me tell you a bit about, and a very little bit, about 19th century wave theory of light. You may think that the wave theory of light was invented not in the 19th century but in the 17th century by Huygens. And you're probably right and you're probably wrong. People didn't take Huygens very seriously. It was only in the 19th century, because of the dominance of Newton, of course, but it was only in the 19th century that the wave theory began to be taken seriously and was resuscitated by a young British physician and scientist, Thomas Young, who wrote several papers, I think in his early 20s, and they were published beginning in 1800. And in one of his early papers, what he did was to postulate that light consists of waves waving in an ether, which is very rare and highly elastic. When he published his paper, his initial paper, which was a very odd paper indeed, because instead of just giving arguments in favor of his theory, what he did was to take from the writings of what would seem to be the archenemy of the wave theory, Isaac Newton, who propounded the particle theory, he took very selectively from Newton's writings and translated them into, some of them were from the Principia in Latin and some of them were from the Optics in English. And he put them together and showed how Newton himself was a kind of wave theorist, thereby lending authority to the theory that he himself wished to defend. Well, no sooner had he published his initial result than Henry Broome, one of the founders of the Edinburgh Review, wrote a scathing review of Thomas Young. And I'll quote you just a little bit of Henry Broome's review. Broome began by saying of Thomas Young's paper, "As this paper, Young's, contains nothing which deserves the names either of experiment or discovery, and as it is in fact destitute of every species of merit, we should have allowed it to pass among the multitude of those articles which must always find admittance into the collections of a society which is pledged to publish two or three volumes every year." Broome went on to insult Young even in a more flagrant way, but it didn't work. Young at least seemed to have the goods, though it remained for the French engineer Fresnel around 16 or so to write his famous prize essay, in which he gave a mathematical defense of the wave theory of light. Let me briefly give you the sort of arguments that were standard among the wave theorists, who I say included Thomas Young and Augustin Fresnel and Herschel and many others. Both Herschel and Lloyd wrote long review articles in which they compared the wave theory of light and the particle theory of light, and of course in both cases the wave theory came out on top. The first assumption, and this is the basic form of their argument, which I'll go over in a little more detail, because recall it is an argument to the existence of what is absolutely unobservable, an ether, and waves waving in an ether. And this is what light is supposed to consist of. The assumption which began, they began their arguments in general as follows. That is, they assumed that light is either a wave phenomenon or a stream of particles. Then they showed how each of these theories explained known optical phenomena. There were lots of phenomena known about light, for example, that it travels in straight lines, that it can be reflected, that it's refracted, and so forth. Then they showed, they meaning the wave theorists, showed that the particle theory, in explaining some of these phenomena, introduces very improbable assumptions, but the wave theory does not. That is, in explaining the phenomena, they showed how these phenomena, such as the fact that light travels in straight lines, that it's refracted in accordance with Snell's law and so on. They showed how these assumptions just tumble out of, very cleanly and neatly, out of the assumptions of the wave theory. But some of these, particularly diffraction, that's the sort of the way the light can bend around corners and obstacles, they showed how in explaining diffraction, the particle theorists had to introduce very improbable assumptions. And they concluded from this that the wave theory is very probably true and the particle theory is very probably false. Let me now present a more intuitive way of viewing the wave theorist's argument. I think I have this on one of these slides. Let me see if I do. Well, that's the probability version of it. Okay. I was told not to give you any formulas at all, so if you don't like formulas, close your eyes. The first step in the argument was that one argues to the particle or wave theory, that is, one of these theories is most likely true, from the fact that light travels in straight lines in a finite time. In fact, the emphasis was on light traveling in a finite time. It does not travel infinitely fast, unlike what Descartes thought. In nature, the only known causes of finite motion are particles moving in a straight line and waves moving through some kind of a medium. So probably light, since it does travel from one point to another in a finite time, probably light consists of particles or waves. And if you like formulas, mostly I don't, but you can look at the first one, which says that the probability, P, R is probability, P is the particle theory of light, W is the wave theory of light, O is the fact that light travels in straight lines in a finite amount of time, and B is the background information, which includes the fact that the only known things in nature to do this are particles and waves. So the first argument is that the probability of the particle theory or the wave theory, given the information that we, this limited information, is close to one. Now, that's the first step in the argument. The second step consists of an argument against the particle theory. On the particle theory, diffraction, which, as I mentioned, is the ability of light to bend around corners a little bit with causing diffraction bands on a screen, and also to spread when going through a tiny aperture, and you see diffraction bands. On the particle theory, diffraction is produced how? Well, if light consists of particles, it has to be produced by some forces on the issued by the diffractor on the particles of light at a distance. In other words, you have to postulate short-range attractive and repulsive forces. And this, say Young and Fresnel, is extremely likely given the other assumptions of the particle theory. Given that light consists of particles, that's what in all likelihood is producing the diffraction. So the probability, H is this auxiliary hypothesis that the diffraction is caused by short-range forces. Given the particle theory, P, and given the observations we have, and B is the background information, the probability that given the particle theory is true, that diffraction is produced in this way is close to one. But, and now they stick the knife in, observation shows that these postulated forces, these supposed forces, do not vary with the mass or shape of the diffractor. That's what indeed Fresnel showed. And such forces are extremely unlikely given everything else that's known about forces, because all other forces do vary with the mass and shape of the object causing the force. So just on the basis of everything else we know, in other words, if we don't assume that the particle theory is true, the probability that the diffraction is, that H is true, the probability that the diffraction is caused by these kinds of forces is extremely low. It's close to zero. And from 2 and 3, you get step 4, that the probability of the particle theory P, given what we know, is close to zero. All right. Now, what we have then is given a certain limited amount of knowledge and background information, it's very unlikely that the particle theory is true. But now the wave theorist doesn't want to stop there, because what he wants to show is that the particle theory the wave theory is very probable given everything we know about light, not just given a few phenomena and some background information. So what the wave theorist does, and this is how the wave theorist spent most of his time, is to show that all the other optical phenomena tumble out of the wave theory without making any improbable assumptions. At least that's the ideal. That's what's wanted. And if you can show that, that is, since the wave theory together with all the background information entails all the other observations, then it follows from simple probability considerations that the wave theory has a very high probability given all the known optical phenomena. And that's exactly, and since the probability of the wave theory is very high, at least as great as the wave theory without these optical phenomena, you can conclude in step 7 that which I already concluded, namely that the probability of the wave theory on all the optical phenomena is as close to 1 as you like. William Huell writing in the 1840s, said that the wave theory was absolutely certain. Probability of one. Okay. We now know, of course, that the wave theory is just as false as the particle theory. But in the mid-19th century, the wave theorists won the battle, the particle theorists lost. There's an even simpler way to view this picture. Let me see if that's on the next slide here. Yeah. You can view it in terms of causation. You have a certain effect which is observed, the finite velocity of light. Effect E is observed. Now, the only known causes of effects of that type are C1 and C2, particles or waves. So probably this effect is caused by either particles or waves in step 2, and now step 3, but probably this effect, probably this cause, in this case particles, does not cause this effect, the finite velocity of light, because if it did, then diffraction, a phenomenon, a well-known phenomenon of light by the 19th century, then diffraction would have to be caused by long and by short-range attractive and repulsive forces which satisfy certain conditions. But this is, given what we know about the effects of these forces, this is in all probability false. So probably the second thing causes the effect, that is, waves, given the information that we have so far. But if waves cause this effect, then waves exist. Okay? And that would also explain the other effects of light, because these other effects of light follow right from the wave theory. So probably, in step number 6, waves exist, and waves cause this effect that we began with, given everything that we know. Okay. This, in summary, is perhaps an idealized version of the wave theorist's argument. It gets more messy than this because, of course, as with any situation in science, the wave theorists couldn't explain everything about light. There were problems, some problems with the wave theory. But this is the kind of, but some of them were ignored. This is the sort of argument that they, for the most part, gave and would have liked to have given. All right. What's important in this approach? Two ideas, I think. The first is what I'll call independent warrant. And the second is the idea of explanation. Independent warrant is this, that you can't just postulate, when you're dealing in this mysterious realm of unobservables, of light waves which you don't see, waving in an ether which you can't see, when you're dealing in this strange world, you can't just postulate any entities you like from which the observed phenomena follow and are explained. You must have some independent reason to think such entities exist. In other words, these physicists were opposed to, at that time, what was called the method of hypothesis, or what we today call the hypothetico-deductive method, which is simply postulate whatever you like, derive from those postulations observable consequences, check the observable consequences. If they're true, you verified your theory. If they're not true, you falsified your theory. In LSE, the most famous representative of a point of view of this sort was Karl Popper, who didn't believe in verification, but certainly believed in the other side of the coin, falsification. Herschel, in the mid-19th century, was a very good representative of this school of thinking, not the hypothetico-deductive, but of the idea of independent warrant. I have a quote here. Herschel was one of those very few scientists who understood the mathematics of the wave theory and also the philosophy behind it. He wrote works, he wrote a very important encyclopedia article on the theories of light, which got very mathematical, and he also wrote works in philosophy of science. This is John Herschel. What Herschel writes, and I'll quote just a little bit, is this: in framing a theory, which shall render a rational account of any natural phenomenon, we have first to consider the agents on which it depends, or the causes to which we regard it as ultimately referable. These agents are not to be arbitrarily assumed. They must be such as we have good inductive grounds to believe do exist in nature and do perform a part in phenomena analogous to those we would render an account of, or such whose presence in the actual case can be demonstrated by unequivocal signs. They must be veri causae, in short, which we can not only show to exist and to act, but the laws of whose action we can derive independently by direct induction from experiments purposely instituted. So you can't just postulate any entities you want. You must have some independent inductive reasons to think that such entities exist. Now, independent warrant in the case of the wave theorists is supplied by a form of eliminative causal inductive reasoning, if I can put all these three words together. There are several arguments of this type. The first I mentioned to you is the first step in the argument to the fact that it's either particles or waves, which is producing the finite velocity of light. That is, light is observed to have a certain property. The only things known in nature to cause that property are particles and waves, so probably it's either particles or waves which are causing light to have this property of finite velocity. And there are many other cases in which such arguments are given. So the wave theorists don't just begin by saying, let's suppose that light consists of waves and see where it goes. They give some reason to think that light consists either of particles or waves, and then they give some independent reason to say it's not particles. One of the most famous arguments is the one I rehearsed that has to do with the diffraction of light. All right, that's the first important element in this approach, the idea of independent warrant. And the second important element I take to be the element of explanation. That is, once you've established that the wave theory is probable given a certain limited set of observed phenomena, you want to show that the wave theory is probable given all the optical phenomena, or given as many as you can. You don't want it to be probable just on a few data. You want it to be probable on all the data that you have. So what you do is you try to derive and explain the rest of the optical phenomena from the wave theory. And this will at least sustain, according to a very elementary probability theory, this will at least sustain the high probability of the wave theory, which is established initially by the independent warrant. Okay. Now, let me put these two things together, independent warrant and explanation, because they're both crucial, I think, in providing evidence for the unobservable thing that you postulate. And that's, again, where we began. We want to be able to postulate some unobservable thing, and we want to give an argument for it, an argument which does provide evidence for its existence. Now, in another place, I have defended a view of evidence which involves probability. Nancy mentioned this. I'm not a Bayesian in the usual sense. On my view, what's required for evidence, for some body of information E to be evidence for some hypothesis H, are two things. First, that H, the hypothesis, be highly probable given E. And second, that there be some explanatory connection between the hypothesis and the evidence. Or more specifically, that the probability that there is an explanatory connection between the hypothesis and the evidence, given the truth of the hypothesis and the evidence, be very high. Now, if you have either without the other, if you simply have high probability, you won't have evidence. And if you simply have the probability of an explanatory connection, given the assumption that both the hypothesis and the evidence are true, you also won't have evidence. But if you have both, I maintain that you do have evidence. And that's exactly what the wave theorists had. The independent warrant gave them high probability that their theory is true, and the fact that they could explain various optical phenomena, they tumbled out of the theory deductively from the assumptions of the wave theory, gave them the second aspect, the explanatory connection. All right. This is how, in essence, they argued for their theory, and as I said, they won the day. By the 1840s, there were few, if any, particle theorists left. There are various objections that can be raised. John Worrell has, in a recent review of my book, raised all kinds of objections. Perhaps in the discussion, he will honor me by raising them again. But I want to mention two that you might want to raise. And one is this, that you cannot infer from what is observed to what is unobservable. The unobservable world may be very different from the observable one. And I want to give very brief replies to these objections. My reply to this one is that the unobserved world may be very different from the observed one. Does that mean we can't make inferences from what has been observed to what has not yet been observed? I think not. And indeed, even a confirmed empiricist such as Isaac Newton never held that you cannot infer the unobservable, anything about the unobservable world from what is observed. Indeed, Newton's four rules of reasoning allow you to do just that. The second objection is this, and again I'll be very brief. It sounds as if I'm saying in order to proceed in science, you have to enumerate all the possible hypotheses. And here the wave theorists only enumerated two, the wave theory and the particle theory. I'm not saying that at all. You can rarely, if ever, enumerate all possible causes of some effect, but you don't have to. All you have to do is enumerate, as it were, the most likely ones, or at least the ones that gobble up most of the probability. What you want to show is that the probability of C1 to cause C1 or C2 is very, very high, much as a doctor does when you come in with symptoms. He doesn't want to bore you with all the logical possibilities of your illness. He'll pick out the ones that are the most likely and eliminate from that list. All right, so much for the wave theory of life. I want to turn more briefly to the middle of the 19th century and to work done by probably the greatest theoretical physicist of the 19th century, James Clerk Maxwell. Now, Maxwell is most well known not for his work on kinetic theory on molecules, but for his work on electromagnetism. His work on kinetic theory was enormously important. In fact, he had one of the great laws of physics named after him, the Maxwell distribution law, or Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution law for molecular velocities. Now, in 1860, Maxwell published a very long, very unreadable, very difficult mathematical paper on the dynamical theory of gases, and he made lots of assumptions about what neither he nor anyone else observed or even hoped to observe, namely molecules, only he called them particles. That gases are composed of these unobservable molecules, that the molecules are in motion, that they move in straight lines unless they hit some other molecules or the sides of the container, that the motion is Newtonian in character, that the forces between molecules are zero except at impact, and so on, and that the molecules are spherical. He even gave them a shape. Now, from these assumptions, he derived lots of formulas. And I spent long amounts of time trying to figure out his derivations. Finally, I had to go to a theoretical physicist at Hopkins, and he spent a long amount of time trying to figure out Maxwell's derivations. It's not something that you want to do in your spare time. He derived numbers of things which we still use today and are still taught in courses on kinetic theory. Many of the things we now accept, he derived some results which he was very embarrassed by. At the end of the paper, what does he conclude? Well, he doesn't, unlike the wave theorists of light who had a great ability to see truth in everything they wrote, Maxwell was much more guarded. Maxwell did not claim that his kinetic theory of gases was true. He did not claim it was probable. What he claimed is, or that it's confirmed, or indeed that there was any evidence for it. He didn't quote a single experiment. What he claimed was that it's worth thinking about. To quote him, the precise nature of this motion of the molecules becomes a subject of rational curiosity. And he wrote to his friend Stokes, if I can find the quote here, he wrote to his friend Stokes in 1859 after he had written the initial version of the paper. Maybe I can't find it. Let's see here. 162. I do not know how far such speculations about molecules may be found to agree with facts. And at any rate, as I found myself able and willing to deduce the laws of motion of systems of particles acting on each other only by impact, that is, the molecules, I have done so as an exercise in mechanics. Now, do you think that there is any so complete a refutation of this theory of gases as would make it absurd to investigate it further so as to found arguments upon measurements of strictly molecular quantities before we know whether there be any molecules? So he was skeptical at best. But Maxwell also rejected the hypothetical deductive form of reasoning. He was very sure that this was a completely fallacious mode of reasoning. That is, he could have said, look, here I've given you a series of postulates about these unobserved, unobservable things. I know of no way of observing these things. I've given you a series of postulates. I've performed profound deductions from which you can derive known phenomena about gases. He was very clear about that. But he didn't conclude from that that since he derived what's known experimentally, that the theory was probable or confirmed. He was an opponent of the hypothetical deductive method of doing science. And in later years, he wrote the following. In attempting the extension of dynamical methods to the explanation of chemical phenomena, we have to form an idea of the configuration and motion of a number of material systems, each of which is so small that it cannot be directly observed. We have, in fact, to determine from the observed external actions of an unseen piece of machinery its internal construction. The method which has been for the most part employed in conducting such inquiries is that of forming a hypothesis and calculating what would happen if the hypothesis were true. If these results agree with the actual phenomena, the hypothesis is said to be verified, so long at least as someone else does not invent another hypothesis which agrees still better with the phenomena. That's the hypothetical deductive method. That's the method Maxwell rejected. Well, what type of reasoning did Maxwell employ? He did employ a type of reasoning. And some call this type of reasoning a logic of pursuit or discovery, by contrast to a logic of proof or justification. Charles Peirce, father of American pragmatism, who taught at my own university, introduced several terms for this sort of reasoning, the most famous of which are retroduction and abduction. Peirce emphasized that this is a form of reasoning. It's not just speculation or just making up guesses, but it's reasoning, but it's not reasoning to truth or probability, but to possibility, to something worth considering. Peirce distinguished this sort of reasoning from deduction and induction, which is inference to truth or probability. And Peirce also emphasized that this form of reasoning, this retroduction or abduction, includes practical as well as epistemic factors. That is, you need, says Peirce, to consider the practical costs of pursuit, the time, money, and energy spent, unlike the case with deduction and induction. If an induction is valid whether it's interesting, whether anybody cares about it, whether it's going to make any money for you, whether it's going to get a grant for you. This other kind of reasoning, said Peirce, is quite different. Let me apply this to Maxwell. There are two or three, at least, parts of Maxwell's defense of his claim that his theory is worth pursuing. First, Maxwell spends some time in motivating his theory, that is, in explaining what type of theory is sought and why. There were numerous known phenomena having to do with gases, including the famous gas laws. And they needed, said Maxwell, to be organized and unified. Then, said Maxwell, look, mechanical theories, theories having to do with particles in motion subject to forces, have been successful in other areas of physics. So let's try. We don't know whether mechanical theories are going to work here, but let's try a mechanical theory which is quantitative, in which we can apply some of the laws of Newtonian physics, and let's see how far we get. And that's exactly what Maxwell did. The bulk of his paper is devoted to various kinds of derivations and explanations. There are a few justifications for the assumptions that Maxwell made, but very few. In fact, some would say none at all. Maxwell had no independent reason for thinking that molecules move in straight lines. Joule had said in the 1840s that they have a circular motion. There was no justification for Maxwell supposing that molecules are spherical in shape. There was no justification for Maxwell supposing that they impact only when they collide, that there are no action at a distance. But yet he made all these assumptions. How is this different from reasoning to the truth or probability of a theory? Well, recall the two components earlier, the independent warrant and the explanatory connection. This reasoning of Maxwell, this abductive or retroductive reasoning, does not require independent warrant for any, for all or any of the assumptions. And indeed, as I've mentioned, in 1860, Maxwell had practically no independent warrant for any of the assumptions that he made. There is, however, a good deal of time spent on the second on the second aspect, namely the explanatory connections. In fact, most of the time in Maxwell's paper is spent in showing all the things that you can derive and explain via his theory. And so that's the first way in which this type of reasoning is different from the sort of reasoning that the wave theorists use. It has the explanatory part, but it lacks the independent warrant. And the second way this type of reasoning is different is because the reasoning is, as I would put it, highly contextual. Maxwell very importantly considers the context, the motivation. Why should we even try to argue in this way? We should try to argue in this way because mechanical theories seem to work in other areas, and because physicists are interested in applying mechanical theories not just to the heavens and the planets and so on, and not just to electrical phenomena, which Maxwell and others had tried to do, but also to gases and the fundamental units of matter. The reasoning here is of the sort very frequently used in research grant proposals, when you don't yet have the goods. You want to apply for a research grant to work on X, Y, or Z. You haven't proved yet in the laboratory or elsewhere that this hypothesis is so, but you want to argue that it's worth pursuing, that it's important, and so you give this kind of reasoning and you try to justify, indeed, your budget. You try to justify arguing that there is sufficient money, time, and energy to pursue this project. All right, let me draw certain conclusions from this and see where this leads, certain implications. Very respectable scientists, and not just metaphysicians and theologians, have in fact argued for unobservables, and I do mean, again, inaccessible ones, ones that scientists at the time did not know, did not observe, and did not know how to observe. Moreover, they did so without arguing that these unobservables are useful fictions. That is, the wave theorists and Maxwell were not instrumentalists, they were realists. They believed that the entities that they postulated existed and were not just useful fictions for getting from observables to other observables. One type of argument that used by the wave theorists infers the truth or high probability of the theory that the unobservable exists. Such an argument can indeed be a very reasonable one. To be sure, the conclusion may turn out to be false, as was the case with the luminiferous ether, but John Stuart Mill, I think, was mistaken in rejecting the wave theory, which he did in System of Logic. He rejected the wave theory of light solely on the grounds that the wave theorists had not observed the ether or even said how to observe the ether. Most physicists on both sides of the wave-particle debate did not demand that the postulated entity be observed or be observable in known ways. Otherwise, the particle theorists would also have been in trouble. No one had ever seen a particle of light. You don't need to observe X or even know how to observe X to have a very powerful argument that X exists. The wave theorists of light, right up to the beginning of the 20th century, produced a good deal of evidence for the existence of the ether. And it's very curious, very interesting to me, that Maxwell himself was invited in the 1870s to write an article on the ether. This was in the 1870s, write an article on the ether for the Encyclopedia Britannica. And he did so with great gusto. He provided what he and others regarded as very strong evidence for its existence and for its mathematical properties as well. And Kelvin, Lord Kelvin, who came to Johns Hopkins in 1884 and delivered the famous Baltimore lectures, which were all about the ether and the wave theory of light, wrote as follows. Instead of saying we know nothing about the ether, I say we know more about it than we do about air or water, glass or iron. It's far simpler. There's far less to know. Yet neither wave theorists nor anyone else ever observed the ether. What empiricists such as Young, Fresnel, Herschel, Kelvin, and Maxwell demanded to believe in the ether was not that you see it or observe it, but that you give evidence that it exists. Using the second type of reasoning, the kind that Maxwell used, you argue for a theory without arguing that it's true or probable. That's exactly the way Maxwell proceeded. He argued that the kinetic theory was worth pursuing. The two types of arguments are quite different, though both share certain features. It's possible to argue reasonably that a theory is true or probable without arguing or showing that it's worth considering. For example, it may be too trivial or of insufficient interest, even though it's true or quite probable. And the converse is also true, as is clear in Maxwell's case. You can argue reasonably that a theory is worth pursuing, worth funding, without showing that it's true or probable. And now, finally, for observability. The history of science is replete with examples of scientists and philosophers of science who have a terror of postulating unobservable entities. They have a fear of the dark. Yet the history of science is also replete with examples of the postulation of such unobservables, from the atoms of the ancient Greeks to the molecules in the mid-19th century, to the neutrinos of the 1930s, to the latest superstrings in 10-dimensional space-time. Such unobservable entities, when first postulated, were not only not observed, but no means for observing or detecting them was known. Later, often much later, these entities, or some of them, came to be observed. For example, large molecules now observable or said to be observable with electron microscopes. Neutrinos came to be observed in the 1940s, or at least detected in some way. And of course, as you probably know, the top quark was just detected, even though it was postulated some time ago before it was detected. What counts as observing varies with the science, the instruments available, and the contexts. Scientists learn how to observe in new ways with new instruments that produce some causal interaction with whatever they're trying to observe. Observing some postulated entity or process may be very difficult to do because the entity is very tiny or short-lived or interacts with very few things, or the instruments of detection are not available, or, and so on and so on. Observing X does have an advantage. If you observe it, then it exists. And if you know you're observing it, then you know it exists. So observing X is a very convincing proof of existence. But you don't have to observe X to have very strong evidence, even conclusive evidence, that X exists. Perrin, in 1908, I'm afraid I missed my lecture the other day on Perrin, but I'm going to try to give it on June 1st for those of you who are interested. Perrin, in 1908, offered such evidence for the existence of molecules. Even though neither he nor anyone else in 1908 or even 1913, when his famous book on atoms was published, ever saw a single molecule. By 1913, the physics world believed with a certainty of one that molecules exist, though no physicist had ever seen one. At a stage in scientific investigation, when a method for observing some postulated entity is not known, it's still possible to offer strong arguments for its existence from what can be observed. What empiricism should demand in order for scientists to rationally believe that X exists is not that X be observed or even observable, but only that there be some empirical evidence that X exists. To appropriate President Roosevelt's comforting line to our purposes, there's nothing to fear about the unobservable world but fear itself. Those who feared such a world, as did Mach and Ostwald in the late 19th century, lived to regret it. What finally convinced Ostwald to believe in molecules was not seeing one, but the overwhelming evidence, particularly from Perrin and Einstein's work on Brownian motion. Only seeing is believing is bad philosophy and even worse science. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter, for a lovely talk. We'll have a 5-minute break and reconvene for questions and discussions, but only after 5 minutes, since we've got a time limit at the other end.